This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
Our second session of the day, it's the emotional well-being of a child.
Right. Now, the Ministry of Health have some pretty frightening statistics among Malaysian students. From 1 in 10 individuals in 2011 to 1 in 5 in 2016, it is the worsening state of mental health problems.
Let's invite our speakers. First up, Senior Consultant, Child and Adolescent Psychiatrist, Head of the Department of Psychiatry and Mental Health, Selayang Hospital, Dr. Toh Chin Lee. Joining him on the stage is Consultant Pediatrician and Adolescent Medicine Specialist. He's the Kedah State Consultant of Pediatrics at the Hospital Sultana Bahia, Dr. Ann Thiagar.
Okay, folks, hello, good afternoon. I hope you've had a very good lunch. But let's kick things off with, I guess, that very frightening statistic and how quickly that seems to have descended in a period of about 5 years. So for both of you gentlemen, can you tell us how our children are faring in general when it comes to mental health issues?
If you follow the statistics, actually, whatever screening that's been done at least four different times. The first screening that we ever did for child and adolescents, that means below the age of 16, was in 1996. That time we found a figure of 13%, very high, almost more than 1 in 10, right? And then 10 years later, in 2006, when we repeated it, it was 20%, exactly as what Umar said. But I'm happy to report that when we repeated the similar figure, it has now dropped down to 12%. So 2015, our figure has dropped down to 12% from 20% of 2006, and also around 20% in 2011.
What changed? Did we get better?
Actually, the study doesn't address what changed, but I'm guessing that a number of things might have happened, creating awareness, doing a lot of responsible parenting, getting more and more people involved in making sure that we manage our children better, we manage their emotions better, we make sure that they get good, unconditional love, tough love, without being punitive. You know, those are the things that I think has been happening.
You know, we have, following, I guess, the events of what happened at the Tafis school with corporal punishment, UNICEF has kind of urged Malaysia to put an end to it. We have trouble with that. Why do you suppose that is? We have a real issue with giving up corporal punishment. I mean, Ezra and I have done a few shows, even on radio, and the overwhelming feedback from parents is, I was beaten and I'm okay. Why should I not hit my child?
You see, the figures do not support that. You see, we know that when you hit a child, yes, for that time itself, when you hit the child, you have successfully quietened or
scared the bejesus out of them, yes.
Scared the whatever out of the child, you know. But we know that it lasts only for that little instant. And if we are honest with ourselves, why do we hit our children? Whenever I ask that question, the stock answer is, I want to teach my child. Isn't it right? Has anybody ever answered anything less than that? If you have, you would have been not very honest, because the main reason why people hit their children is not because we want to teach them, because we're angry with them for whatever reason. They didn't follow what we say. They're doing something dangerous. They are doing something that is not allowed. So we're angry with them, actually. And then we use the reason that we want to teach them. But if you really want to teach them, there are many other methods you can effectively teach them without actually hitting them. When you hit someone, when you hit a child, you're only teaching them for that moment. After that, there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of hiding behind, so that the next time they will make sure that whatever wrong that they did that you hit them for, they will do it behind your back so that you don't know. Most of them may not have learned the lesson. If you use other methods of punishment, you find that not just us finding, but the research also shows that the effects tend to be much longer lasting, that we teach people how to manage themselves, how to manage their emotions, get things done properly. And the research on that is very clear. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, if you look at WHO Convention of the Rights of the Child, it's all there, you know. Not using corporal punishment, using other non-punitive means.
Dr. Thiagar, let's skew slightly older for a second. You deal with a lot of adolescents. In the news, we've been hearing lots of horror stories with suicide attempts, with setting fire to things, and also, most recently, the availability of cheap, stimulating drugs to help kids cope with exams and homework.
Interestingly, I remember my uncle, obviously my uncles don't study consistently, they were studying just before the exam. So they used to tell me that I'm going to get some medication, sleeping tablets. And they always say that, sleeping tablets to keep me awake to study. And they just buy it from the sundae shop. And that guy will usually take the medicine out from one of those secret drawers. When I went to medical school, then I understood most likely they were actually taking some stimulant drugs, just like your ecstasy, to stay awake to study. So it was there, I remember, in the 60s and 70s. I suppose, Uma, your generation, probably they didn't have it. Going back to this high-risk behavior, okay, how many of you have never climbed trees? Okay, it's 1, 2, 3, about 4 or 5 of you are a bit abnormal. Okay, so those days our grandparents told us, you know, don't climb trees, you know, it's dangerous. But we did it. Nowadays, you don't have to climb trees to pluck your rambutans. You just go to Pasar Malam, you get it. So what do they climb? They ride on motorbikes. They do dangerous things. So we did dangerous things too. How many of you have never argued with your parents?
Okay, one kid. Good
only
job.
One. I empathize with you. You will need to go back to your adolescent age. So if you have teenagers at home who never argue with you, then you have a time bomb at home. Right? Arguing, high-risk behavior, it's fairly challenging themselves. They like to try new things. And that is why they do all these high-risk behaviors. They know it's dangerous, but they want to try it out.
Doc, when does it tip over into unacceptable high-risk behavior? Because that's what we've been reading about more and more these days.
So what happens is often if you go unsupervised, if your child is leaving home, they should not leave after Maghrib. Nobody should leave after Maghrib. If at all you leave home, it should be your parents or someone elder or someone who can supervise you out there. But nowadays, kids are going out around 8, 9, and then they loiter around. They're on motorbikes, they're on cycles. Here it boils down to parenting. What are the parents doing? Why are they not supervising their children? When they're out there, it's a very dangerous area, be it on the road or with bad company. So this is when they get involved with others when they're unsupervised for a long period of time. If you actually sort of allow them a limited kind of, you know, you can ride a motorbike with license, with a helmet, all the safety issue involved, then they're probably safe. And so meaning that they must be supervised in whatever they do.
It's interesting because the both of you have expressly alluded to this. It's the lack of supervision on the part of, I guess, parents, teachers and grown-ups that seems to be a primary issue.
That's right, because here in Malaysia, we tend to, anything goes wrong, it's the government is at fault. Discipline issue is not parenting issue, they blame the teachers. Parents will never blame themselves. When the parent children do very well, they take pride. It's my child, you know. If the child fails the exam, it's all you. You never studied. So the problem, we always tend to blame others. I'm not sure what to
do.
I agree. That the primary responsibility has to be the family, the parents. It has to be. We then give secondary responsibility to other people for other areas. But the primary responsibility has to be us as parents.
So we talked about those statistics earlier on, and I was wondering if you gentlemen have, or does the Malaysian government have statistics on the number of children below the age of 16 who are afflicted by disorders like anxiety and depression? Do we know?
We don't have very specific figures. We only have very general figures. My memory is a bit rusty, but I know that in Malaysia, interestingly, the study that we did screened parents. Parents are reporting on the children. And what was really surprising was many Malaysian parents list their children as reasonably well behaved because the conduct disorder portion of our screening was very low. You know, we were all surprised because we always worry that, you know, our children have problems with their behavior and their conduct. So based on that, our screening instrument, it should be very high points for our screening for conduct. But strangely, it was very low, 1.2%.
And you were expecting?
Something much higher than that, yes.
You know why, right? Because you keep it at home and you don't want to embarrass people in public, right? That's why you don't want to tell people, oh, my child is badly behaved. And, you know, I think that honesty is something that's absolutely crucial. But tell me this, how equipped in your dealings with Malaysian parents, how equipped are Malaysian parents to be able to spot and at least make those initial diagnosis, pre-diagnosis, if you will, that, hey, maybe I need to take my kid to see a specialist or to see someone?
Generally, this falls under what internationally has been termed mental health literacy. Mental health literacy is the ability to know about, you know, what are the things that make you mentally well, how to handle stress, how to make decisions for your own mental health, how to recognize basic common symptoms that indicate that you may not be mentally healthy. And when you can recognize that, where to go for help if you need to get help. And generally in Malaysia, I think mental health literacy for Malaysians is very low. So this kind of forum that we're having today actually will hopefully improve the mental health literacy of all the attendees. Unfortunately, not enough people can attend this sort of thing. So we have to approach this at a much different level. When you want to look at the Malaysian population as a whole, we have to educate and bring up the so-called mental health literacy of Malaysians in a more wholesale way than what we are doing today, which I am using the analogy of a retail way. You know? 500 of you are improving your knowledge about mental health. But we will wish that it is more than that. It's 5 million. You know, it's the whole 33 million of Malaysians, you know.
If I could get the both of you to maybe lay out some basics when it comes to mental health literacy, what should parents be aware of? What are some of the things they should look out for? I know it's a case-to-case thing, but in general...
Can I speak about the children first and I leave Dr. Tiaga for the adolescents? For children, it's very important that as parents you know your child reasonably well, if not very well. My standards are not very high. I say reasonably well. That means you must know that at different levels what to expect of them. You don't expect them to be able to do certain things when they are very young. But as they grow older, of course, your expectations will gradually increase based on their developmental. No, I don't need all of us to become specialists in child development. You don't need to do that. You leave that to people like Dr. Tiaga and myself. It's fine. But you should know the basics. And there are many books and many things in the internet that you can read about. So at least know the development of the usual development. Don't expect too much from your children. Know your children's emotions at a different age. You know, again, you do not expect too much of them. Give them unconditional love. Be positive in your parenting. Praise them. Many Malaysians dare not praise their children. Why? Because we worry that when we praise our kids, the head becomes very big and it will be heavy and it will topple over and you have to catch them. No, no, no.
That is awkward laughter because that's what they do.
Yeah. Praise is important, but appropriate praise, not excessive and over the top, unrealistic praise. I don't agree with that either. All right. So we must be very positive in the way we parent our children. And if you Google positive parenting, lots of things will come out. And I'm sure many of you are already doing this. But we want a bigger proportion of Malaysian parents to be doing positive parenting other than the olden, medieval, punitive punishment kind of lock them up kind of thing. All right.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
Dr. Tiaga, I guess slightly harder with adolescents, right?
It's more difficult, but as it's taken from what Dr. Toa said, you must deal with them in a developmentally appropriate manner. So once your child is already a teenager, you need to start respecting them, start listening to them. You must listen to them. The problem teenagers face most of the time, parents don't listen to them. That is why they talk to others. So start listening to them. Don't be too judgmental. If they change their hair color from green to brown or blue...
Brown is okay.
It's okay, bro. So don't be too judgmental. They are being influenced by some funny group of peers. But don't be too judgmental. Listen to them. Talk to them. Give them some space. If they're not ready to talk to you, leave them alone. Approach them again later. But do look out for some signs of mental health issue, like they become unusually irritable. They keep to themselves. They are not eating well. And they are too teary, like, you know, crying too frequently for the minor issues. So be a bit aware of those symptoms and start talking to them. And I think like Dr. Toh said, I think the general population must realize that let's remove this stigmatization that mental health means a stigma. It's not a stigma, it's created by us. In overseas, they have changed, you know. They say if you have anxiety, they approach the doctors themselves. They don't have to wait until it's too late for them to approach the doctors. So I think if you think that the teenagers have got some issues, get some help early. Because if you leave it alone, they may appear to be, you know, recovering. But they come back when they are about 30s and 40s. Many of the mental health issues as adults, if you go back into the history, you'll find out that they got a major traumatizing event during their adolescence.
That went unaddressed.
Can I add one thing? I agree totally with what Dr. Tiaga has said. I just want to point out as a psychiatrist to let you know that in children and adolescents, many of the children and adolescents who are actually depressed do not present with depression symptoms, the sadness and all that. They present in either irritability, a little bit strikes them off, they become very angry, they do horribly angry things, or they take part in a lot of high-risk behavior. Inside, they are actually depressed. The third category will be doing behaviors that may be illegal or whatever. That is also as an underlying issue of what we call, this is the externalizing behavior of depressed children and adolescents. They are unlike adults in that sense.
Question from the floor.
Hi, my name is Syed Azmi. I work with underprivileged mostly. And this is a bit special because you are right, Dr. Toh, and I like going to Hospital Selayang to the psychiatric side because of my beneficiaries. So one of my main problems in regards to children is I do not think we have enough experts. The waiting time to go and find help, it's long. And I've actually voiced it out to appropriate channels, which is being dealt with. I have 4 children below the age of 15 who are predators, who are actually doing to other children. When we have this and we try to find help, you are right. It's not anymore about taboo now. Now, I don't have any problem with it and I'm bringing beneficiaries to go and get help. I cannot find the help. Now, on Dr. Tiaga, I thank God I finally get to meet you. I am meeting up 3 times a week. The 7 children who caused the fire, they are siblings. I'm seeing their family and their siblings. The government has not gone inside yet, and it's fine because there's priorities. So when I saw this, their siblings and the family, they have other issues, but I want them to know that you're also a victim, right? And about their mental health as well. But when I don't have the taboo problem and when our clients are ready to meet up to get help, we cannot find the pathway.
Accessibility.
I agree that we don't have enough experts. It will take us a long time to reach the sort of number of experts that we need, and we are working on that. It's, as you can see, it's not easy. That is why we do, as you say, if there is an urgent need you bring, we will address it. That is for sure. So thank you for acknowledging that. However, we are also looking at the population that, yes, there will be this group where we will have to deal with that way, but we want to address the rest of the group that does not have such a huge problem, that we want you to equip yourselves with the help of whatever resources that are available. We have to increase the resources to make you prevent a lot of these things, to promote your own and your children's good health so that you do not have to fall into that category that Syed Azmi has actually talked about. There will always be that category and we will deal with that. Now, we should also deal with the other bigger category now, which we haven't really been paying as much attention as we should be.
Yeah, I think the word is prevention. If we fail to prevent kids from indulging in difficult or high-risk behavior and eventually become unproductive adults, that's a failure of the society. It's not failure of the parents alone, but also the society. So I think as a society, we must try to identify kids with problems and try to prevent it. And those with real special issues, we need to deal with them by getting them to the specialist.
So one of the questions that often comes up, gentlemen, apart from accessibility and wait times, is, I suppose, cost. So if you can't bear the wait at a government hospital, I'm assuming the cost is still pretty high if you were to take your kids to private healthcare when it comes to mental health issues, am I right?
Both of us are in the government sector, so we're probably not the best people to answer that.
When it comes to children, most of us often try our level best to accommodate them as soon as possible, especially when it's things related to development or issues like mental health issues, because mental health issues can't wait. The longer you wait, the worse. So my own experience with dealing with the child and adolescent psychiatrist in my own hospital, the latest actually within a week you get an appointment because they will try to slot them in because they know that acute cases they need to handle immediately. Only those who are very mild, they say, you know, they touch base with the patient and then they work it out.
We do what is called triage, you know. At least in psychiatry, we have a KPI where we do not make new patients wait longer than 6 weeks.
All right, folks, questions. We have a question in the front.
I've had the bad fortune of having had to take care of 2 mentally unhealthy adults in my life. How much of that can be hereditary? Second is, during the dinosaur times when I was in primary school, we had health services, dental health services, nurse present in the school all the time, taking care of our health. And we had all sorts of doctors, including mental health related doctors, counselors, I mean, looking after us. I see that absent from our present system. Is there any plan, about being from the government, for that to happen in the near future for our children?
So I guess let's address the second question first with the mental health professionals in our schools.
Actually, I don't know. I'm not sure when we ever had. I think at the most we had school nurse. We still have, the Ministry of Health still runs a school health service. We have doctors who and nurses who actually make visits to schools. So, but I'm not in that particular area, so I can't say how much of it that they do. But I understand that they do a lot of health education, vaccination, things like that. Many, many schools which actually the teams have to cover, so their coverage, I can imagine, will be rather be limited.
And the first question being whether these issues are hereditary?
Okay, heritability depends on the diagnosis. Okay, if you are well aware, all the major psychiatric diagnoses, the etiology very often is either unknown or multifactorial. That means it can be due to inherited causes, genetics. There's also the environment and various other issues that come in. What we do know from the literature, for instance, severe mental illness like schizophrenia, is that if you have a parent with schizophrenia, the chances of a particular child having the same schizophrenia will be about 11.6%. If both parents have schizophrenia, then the percentage rises, 25%. But of course, schizophrenia is also triggered by various other factors, so it's not just the genetics. For depression, we know that, again, there's some heritability. For alcoholism, there's also heritability. For antisocial personality disorder, those really psychopathic, sociopathic people, there's also heritability. So you worry about the Trump children, right?
We don't worry, we kind of know already, right? There's a lady in the middle.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm also a parent and a teacher. Quite frankly, you know, as a parent, going back to the, you know, the punitive punishment, I did not punish because I was angry. I think as a parent, we always have to be mindful that we are the adults in the house and that we have to be professional, even as a parent, and that if you do bring the cane to the home, then you have to give it a good reason. And the reason I gave my son when I punished him was because he beat somebody else up. And I wanted him to feel how it was to be helpless and to be at the mercy of somebody else. And that really is the rule system in our country. As a teacher, I've seen a lot of parents who are not present and who themselves have got questionable well-being, you know, status. A lot of that really boils down to the kind of lifestyle we lead. We can't always point fingers at parents and say that they are the ones that are to blame, no. But maybe parents should be given guidance on what positive parenting is. So if BFM could do a parenting course, that'll be good.
Sure, why not?
I think talking about corporal punishment or physical punishment, as Dr. Toh has mentioned, more than 25 studies globally has clearly shown that physical punishment does not help the child at all. In fact, it has got long-lasting issues. For example, children who are physically punished, they tend to become more aggressive and violent adults. They become bullies. They don't do well in studies. They actually don't have how to regulate their own moral values. They don't know what is right and wrong. I just give an example of children. You know, remember those days? I'm not sure how many of us are Generation Jurassic. Huh? Okay. You know, when a child sort of trips and falls down, you know what the grandmother will say? The grandmom will hit the floor and say that, you know,
yes.
Very bad floor.
Bad floor.
So this child, they knock onto the table, they hit the table. You know what this child happens to the child? The child grows up thinking that anything which causes pain, you must hit.
Must hit, yes.
This is why the children, when they go to school, even another child just hits them at the back, the first response is they punch them. And we are also a generation where, when a young kid, you know, as young as 6 months, they'll say, punch uncle on the cheek. They love to keep their child pick. The child grows up aggressive because they role model the adults. So bring them up in this manner. So when you physically hit, the only person who actually gains from physical punishment is the person who hits. What happens when you hit the child? You release your stress, release your anger. The only person who gets something positive from hitting the child is the adult. It's not a child. Because if his hitting is good, why aren't the husband hitting the wife and the wife does something wrong? Or the wife slaps the husband who smokes? Because if you think that that is going to give them good education, then we as adults or more mature will be able to understand the consequences. So if a grandfather does something wrong, the grandchild should punch the grandfather. Because if you believe physical punishment is a learning process, then we should actually hitting each other all the time. But it doesn't work because we know once they're more than 18, we dare not touch them because they're adult. So think back, it's actually physical punishment, we are actually bullying the children. It's difficult when they are really naughty, sometimes can be very stressful. But end of the day, Dr. Toh say, handle it differently. Walk away from the situation, calm down and come back to the child. Just like you tell the child who's very aggressive, go to your room, sit down and calm yourself down, and then we talk about it again. I really hope that nobody walk out of this room thinking that physical punishment actually helps a child.
Bravo, Tiaga. Thank you. Fantastic.
No, but and also I suppose when you talked about mental health literacy as well, I guess literacy when it comes to this sort of knowledge regarding corporal punishment, because I guess for a lot of Malaysians, it comes from how they grew up and what happened to them. And so it's a direct transfer of knowledge, not knowledge, but you know what I mean, practice.
Yeah. I must share one story. I had one friend, he's a retired school principal. You know, when I wrote a small article in a newspaper saying that, you know, physical punishment doesn't help the child, he was very upset. So he said, Tiaga, you don't understand. You know, we have to believe in this, that it's very useful. I said, how is it useful? I said, look at me. My father hit me every time I did something wrong. That is why I became a school principal. And I told him, I sympathize with you. Because if I had not hit you, you'd have probably become some professors. So he never talked about hitting anymore after that.
Wow, that is cold, but it works. We've got a question all the way over here.
Okay, I have 5 kids, and I've never beaten my child. The only thing we talk about is love. And I have one in 22 in university, and one 16-year-old who is now a teenager, and another 14-year-old is also a teenager. Of course, they rebel a lot, but I don't believe in corporal punishment or hitting the child, because when we take the cane, we're telling the child, it's okay to hit. So if a child hits another child and then we hit the child, what are we? No different to what happened. Why not we read and learn about new things that are out there? Because today's world is a lot of computer, a lot of gadgets. You can deprive a child, yes. No need to beat. Just take their phone away. Simple way of depriving a child.
Rules and regulations need to be set.
Yes, correct. And that's what I do. And my children know that, you know, if I did something wrong, okay, I will have to pay for it.
Take the phone away. Sonia?
From the adults first.
I have a friend in Vietnam whose son is an internet addict, and she couldn't find help there, so she asked me, and there's nothing in Southeast Asia actually for anybody who specializes in internet addiction, and I'm sure it's becoming something that's appearing more and more. So can you both, in your roles, do something to advise parents on these dangers?
You're absolutely right. There's hardly any knowledge or information that's widely available out there, even the expertise. However, the good news is that we have a number of pediatricians and also child psychiatrists who have taken an interest in internet addiction. In fact, there is a Malaysian Society of Internet Addiction comprising pediatricians and child psychiatrists. And last year, we had a meeting of the International Association of Internet Addiction Prevention in Malaysia itself, partially sponsored by MCMC. But obviously, this is a very small group of people, and I think they only managed to expose a small group of people. Things should get better as we go along. In fact, the child psychiatrist who's working with me in Selayang Hospital, she regularly does work on internet addiction, so I'll be happy to give you the resource.
It's true. It's like a new drug in the market, you know. The internet addiction is not easy. I do see some teenagers coming in. You just take away their tab, they really freak out. So when you talk to them, then you realize that they're actually addicted. To deal with them is not easy. Not many experts in it, but you still need to set the rules at home and gradually. It took me about 6 months to get him out of it, and he goes back to the, you know, usual revision and all that. Prior to that, he was just for about 8 hours in a day, he'd be on the internet. Yeah, it's a real problem.
But that's where the prevention comes in. That's where all of you will have to make sure that your children never get set on the path to internet addiction. You have to give them other activities to do rather than just being on either the PlayStation or the smartphone or the computer or whatever it is. I'm sure you've gone to restaurants where you see that while waiting for the food, the whole bunch, everybody brings out their iPad. That's not the way you have to make them talk. Looks like the parents themselves are also not talking, so everybody's got a phone or an iPad or whatever is in front of them. That has to stop. That has to change. Otherwise, you know, yeah.
Which isn't all that different from our generation when it was television. And, you know, the same kind of rules and regulations were set in place. This many hours of TV a day, or on weekends. Watch the news. You're allowed to watch the news, but cartoons are, you know.
News must watch.
Must watch, exactly. Dealing with children's sexuality, and especially if they're unsure of their sexuality and if they're confused about their sexuality, this can actually lead to serious issues and it can manifest itself in various ways. So talk to us about children's sexuality and dealing with it.
It's a difficult area, but it's a real issue. Now, not every, say for example, teenager, every teenager who, there's some teenager, say take a girl for example, one of my friend's daughter, he called me up and said, I think she may have some gender issue. She thinks that she only have inclination towards girls, she only likes to talk to girls, she only likes to mix around with girls. But she's very young. So when you ask a few more questions, she's fine. Just that most of us, when you're a teenager, boys like to mix around. Boys, girls like to mix around because we share the same interests and same activities. So naturally, you are closer to your same gender. But that's fairly common, and some of them actually get confused. Hey, why I hardly talk to girls? Is there something wrong with me? They usually commonly question the issue. Majority of them will have that kind of confusion initially. But they're not real pathological situation. After a while, they get used to it. By the time they go to Form 4, Form 5, they start mixing around with the opposite sex. But usually by 13 to 14, they tend to have a bit of confusion. Why am I only mixing around with a certain gender? So that's quite common. But those pathological is a different issue. That I leave it to Dr. Toh.
Everyone's so just passing the buck.
The phase that Dr. Tiaga is talking about is the temporary phase that all of us go through. Attraction to the same sex. But for almost all of us, it is temporary. And then the hormones kick in and then you have no choice, but you know, there you go. But for a small percentage, they have always felt that they have attraction to the same sex. That we cannot deny, you see. But as you are aware, these are very sensitive issues because there's a whole mix of culture, religion, biology, everything is mixed in there, so it becomes a very sensitive issue.
And in communicating with your children, where do parents come in? At which point, I mean, this will be discussed at the last session in greater detail, but
how... Why don't we leave it to them?
Oh, right. You're just going to pass the buck to Paul. That is great.
I think it's right what Dr. Toh said. I mean, if the small percentage actually have a real biological issues, we can't force anything on them. It's their life. So we need to respect their belief or their biological difference. And just like we're talking about inclusion and, you know, we have to accept them within the society. That's important. Otherwise, that's when they get mental health issues, including depression and whatnot.
Oh, I'm just going to look at this side of the hall. There are two questions coming up. Let's go with this row first.
Referring to the examples you gave on hitting on the floor, I think that really struck my mind. One of the panels suggesting to go to an internet to look for information, but a lot of this information are actually very probably Western based, right? I wouldn't say it's hard for us to translate, but what you have given, it's a real scenarios that we face here over based on our culture, right? So it's more easily we understand. Is there any resources that you have wrote that can be shared on the net or in a book that, you know, we can pick it up? Especially for me, I would like to get the information and it's easy to understand and then to guide my children.
Thank you for the question. In fact, the Malaysian Pediatric Association has been doing collaborative work with other NGOs. We have something called Positive Parenting Magazine. They're wonderful. For the past 10, 15 years, a wonderful article on various aspects of child health, including mental health and so on. Those are fantastic articles. You can just download it and read it. And the other thing you're mentioning about setting rules and regulations is very important for children. Even as young as 2 years old, you have to set rules, what is right, what is wrong. But our Malaysian, or rather most of the Southeast Asian countries, we tend to use the word don't more than anything else. Don't do this. You know, I always share this story about President Abdul Kalam. There was a story about him and his sister was sitting outside his home watching Abdul Kalam watching his nephew and niece. They were actually hanging from a tree about 10 feet high. So there was a gush of very strong wind. Abdul Kalam's sister shouted at the daughter, don't fall down. Abdul Kalam screamed at the nephew and said, hold tight. Obviously the girl fell down because our mind, human brain, actually captures the action word first. So the girl heard the word, don't fall down. That's action word. Whereas the boy, the nephew heard, hold tight. He held it. In actual fact, it's real. It's nothing to do with, it's all brain. That's why if you tell a child, the child is running, try telling the child, don't run. They always take a few steps then they stop. If you tell a child, walk, immediately they'll walk. Today, just take your small kid, try to cross the road. If you tell the kid, don't let go, and try the word, hold tight. Just try it out, and you'll get the answer.
Yeah, correct. Can I address that issue about so-called Western?
Yes.
These are all universal values. Don't think that Western people don't hit their children. They do. They do. But the universal value has to be that you have not to do certain things. And our cultures, whether Western culture, Eastern culture, and within Eastern culture, there are many different types of Eastern culture. They're at different levels of progression. So you will see that in certain societies, they've gone through what we have gone through. So instead of us making the same mistakes, why don't we look at what they have gone through and see the mistakes they have made and see all the good things that they have done to overcome those mistakes? We shortcut the process and we follow them.
Right. We've got time for a couple more questions. I haven't taken any questions from here in a while.
I used to teach in the tertiary sector. In one of my classes, I had a boy who behaved very much like a girl. It was a very difficult thing, including his parents and his siblings, right, who used to come and watch out for him so that he doesn't get disturbed, right? His peers had to be educated to take care of him.
Then, sorry, can I interrupt you? I think that's an excellent example. Are you talking about educating the people around him to his needs,
yes,
what he is, and acceptance by them all of what he is? You see?
Yes,
and that is important. Unfortunately, in Malaysia at this time, what you're saying is very difficult.
Okay, thank you.
This is an edited recording of the panel session at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior 2017 event.
What is this pornography they speak of? I am unaware. Now carry on, please. I guess just to get back to the difficulty of what just happened in making sure there's a safe space for especially children, adolescents at that age to be able to cope with whatever changes they're experiencing.
One of the most important things actually is sex education. When I was in Australia, Melbourne for a year, sex education starts when they're preschoolers. In Malaysia, the moment you use the word sex, they think this, we are talking about sex. Everybody knows that. You don't have to teach anybody sex. That's the only reason why we are still there. Human population is still growing. The thing is, we talk about sex education, we're actually talking about safety. That safety including like telling a five-year-old child which are your private areas, like chest, thighs, your buttocks, nobody can touch. If somebody touch inappropriately, you're supposed to scream, get help. Those are things they are taught. It's not about the actual, you know, sex and things like that. So that has to come in. I remember in 2006, if I'm not mistaken, there were more than 40 million was allocated to sort of start off this thing. But along the way, a lot of opposition from, including the teachers, who feel uncomfortable to do this. Then they renamed it as reproductive health. Again, it's there. But I think parents have to start to talk to kids about sex education on all the safety issues. That's when you can bring in your safety against pornography and so on. If every parent can bring up their sons learning to respect the opposite sex, there won't be any rape. Because even if the girl, let's say the girlfriend actually approaches the boy, hey, let's have this. If the boy respects the girl, I say, look, it's not time. He will actually walk away. So the idea is every parent must start learning how to bring up their sons. Don't always focus on the girl's dress and all those things. It's nothing to do with the dress. It's all about the sons. So if all of us bring up the sons well, you have a safer world, literally. Don't always blame their peers and all that. I grew up among gangsters. I grew up among drug addicts. I was probably lucky, somehow resilient to come out of it. I had friends who were drug addicts and alcoholics. We were playing together, we mixed around, but they respected me as much as I respected them. So I think the same way, let's bring up boys respecting the girls.
We have a question over there.
Hello, hi. Actually, in terms of information, I think we are living in an information era. Everything is there. We can learn from Google. A lot of, you know, parenting websites are there. But how we can make this as our lifestyle, I think that's our biggest challenge, because when we are with our kids, sometimes we tend to lose patience, right? I know there's no silver bullet. We have to constantly learn as a human being, as an adult as well. We have to know how to control our emotions. But is there something that we can do as an adult to actually control our emotion and actually become a better parent?
Different people have different ways. But the first thing that I think all of us have to commit to is that no hitting, no violence. What Dr. Tiaga has said is absolutely correct. You have to keep that in mind. You know, and you have to remind yourself, no matter how angry I'm going to deal with it without violence.
I particularly appreciate the taking a break thing, so that you can calm down yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're very angry, yeah. So it's good, calm down.
Just to address this question of whether there's a, or if there is a way that somehow we can start making this a part of our lifestyle.
I mean, this is exactly why we're having this forum. Changing our own mindset. Transform our mind that we have to keep, respect kids, we have to deal with kids and adolescents just like how we wished we have been treated in the past. Let's not go back to, you know, how my parents brought me up and assume that that's the only best way to do things. There are many things they've done right, otherwise we won't be here. But I always tell people, you know, if you see 10 things in a person, if there are one or two good things, take it out. If 9 things are good, take that 9 things, throw away this one or two things which is not good. And we change it, and cumulatively, all of us become better parents, better adults. And don't stop here. Talk to your neighbors about what you gain in this forum. Knowledge must be disseminated. That's very important.
Yeah, start a movement.
All right, folks, last two questions.
Okay, good afternoon. Children, you started off at Taska Kindergarten and all that. They are in a co-ed kind of environment. They move forward to primary school, secondary school. Some of it is in all boys and all girls school. Does it have any psychological effect on them? Especially when you talk about certain families where they have all boys in the family or all girls.
So here, I'm going to my personal view. I always believe that co-ed school is better, so that they get to know the other opposite sex earlier, and they learn to respect each other better, their likes and dislikes differently. So I'm a strong believer that co-ed is better. Although I must admit that my daughter still ended up in a primary school, or she was in a convent, because I couldn't win the battle with my wife.
Speaking as a person who went to an all-boys school, I agree with Dr. Tiaga, because there's too much mystery and wrong mysticism and wrong things about, you know, the opposite sex when you're in the same sex school. Better to have a co-ed school.
Right. In secondary school, she's in co-ed. I won the second battle.
We have our last question. Hello.
Hi. This is in response to the guy that talked about what do you do when you're Asian, like I guess your Asian influence versus your Western influence. Mm-hmm. My husband, I am Malaysian Chinese and he's American Caucasian. And so I absolutely hear you. I absolutely understand. On top of that, we live in a multi-generation household. So it's my mom, my dad, my brother, my sister-in-law.
Well, all the
His
best to you,
comes
sir.
For 4 months of the year. And so what I wanted to say is that there's absolutely so many resources, but above all, everything else is you educate yourself as much as possible. We actually subscribe to this Positive Parenting magazine. Really, it's educating yourself, and then it's also just listening to your gut and seeing what works for you. You know, a lot of times the grandparents or other people will say things like, oh, they say so many things. but in the end, it's still how do we want to raise her and how teaching her to be respectful. Let's open up communication. Let's say hitting is not the answer. Let's talk about it.
I have a question for you, though. Just very quickly, the multi-generational home.
Yes.
Obviously, the grandparents' style versus the parent style versus your style is very different.
Versus the helper style.
Versus the helper style. Do you tell off your parents and your grandparents and go, no, lay off. This is my son. This is my daughter.
So the big thing we always say is pick your battles. So grandpa lets her watch a lot of iPad. And so what we do is, for me, she's two, but she absolutely knows that with grandpa there's different rules and with mama there's different rules. So she only gets to watch TV with grandpa. But and so it's picking battles. So I didn't want him to give her candy or chocolate or like whole nuts because it was a choking hazard for her. And so that one I went to battle, and that one I said, Dad, look, I love you, but no. If it was TV, then it was, it's okay. It's just grandpa time. Because we also moved to Malaysia because we wanted to have kids here. We wanted her to have the kampong, we wanted her to have the community, we wanted her to know what it was like. Because that's what grandpas do. They're meant to spoil you. They're meant to take you to the park because you feel like going to the park. And my job as her mom and his job as dad is to lay back down the law. So that's my advice. If you live in a multi-generation household, pick your battles.
Cool. Thank you very much. I think that's a great note to end on, because a lot of us actually grew up in multi-generational houses, I'm assuming. I don't know how much of that still happens today, actually no, probably a lot more, like, because we can't afford to live by ourselves, right? Folks, thank you so much. A big round of applause to our great panelists.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.